Sunday, January 15th, 2000. Sorry. Sunday, January 5th, 2014, Rabbi David Silber, Migdal Bavel.
Yes. Okay.
Welcome, everybody. Out on a snowy, icy night. Kalakavod, you get extra schar. Welcome to the first part of a two-part series by Rabbi David Silber, who needs really no introduction to our community. He's been responsible for so much wonderful, positive change in the Jewish community, being the founder and dean of Drisha. And he will be speaking on Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Bavel, tonight. And then next Sunday, he'll be speaking on the Megillah, which is a particular interest of his. He's currently writing a book, much awaited book on the Megillah. So without anything further, we give you Rabbi David Silber.
Thank you. Okay, so it's good to be here. There is a connection between the Megillah and Migdal Bavel. It's not just two disparate topics, but we'll see next week what connections we can find. In any event, Migdal Bavel is an extremely interesting topic. The story of Migdal Bavel itself, it's a grand total of 9 psukim in the 11th chapter of Sefer Bereshit. Chapter 11, the first 9 verses. And the question I wanted to address is, what is its place? What is it doing here in this chapter? What is it doing here in the larger context of the creation stories and the book of Bereshit generally? Before we get to that, simply wanted to point out something about the structure of Migdal, of the story itself. The story begins by telling us, the Torah begins by telling us, Vahi kol ha'aretz safa echat u'dvarim achadim, that the world spoke, was of one safa, called a language, Udvarim achadim. Question is, what does dvarim achadim mean? One set of words. Everybody thinks alike. So the world is described as a kind of place of great unity. Everybody's coming together. Second verse says, Vahi b'nasa mikedem, v'yimtzu bika b'yeret shinar v'yeshvu sham. So the Torah says, Vahi b'nasa mikedem. So what does it mean, Vahi b'nasa mikedem? What does mikedem mean? So mikedem could be translated as, in their journeys from the east. That's one possibility. Or mikedem may mean, not from the east, but in the east. So mikedem, in Sefer Bereshit, perhaps elsewhere, I think typically does not mean from, but rather in, such as Vayita Hashem Elokim Gan B'Eden Mikedem, or Vayisa Lot Mikedem, Lot goes to Sodom Mikedem. It's like going from the east, he's going eastward. So Mikedem here, I think, is probably the better translation would be, they traveled in the east, they all came together in Kedem, and they found a Bika, kind of a valley, in the land of Shinar Vayeshvu Sham. So the whole world has come together in Eretz Shinar. And the next pasuk says, Vayomru ish el re'ehu, havanu b'nagu v'nim v'nishrafal v'sreifa, fatiru hem v'nagu yevin, v'achemar ayolahem rachome. The third pasuk tells us that they decide to make bricks. They don't seem to have the proper raw materials. And the Torah says that the Luvena was Evan. They used the Luvena as Evan. And the Chemar, which they translate typically as bitumen, Hayolahem Rachomer, as mortar. So first they decide to make the bricks without, you would have thought the other way around. They said, let's build a city. How are we going to build a city? Let's make bricks. But the Chumash reverses it. First they decide to make the bricks. Now they have the bricks. So what do you do with them? So they decide in the next pasuk, "Vayomru hava nivna lanu ir umigdav roshob shamayim v'nasa lanu shem Let us build, they say, a city, and a tower, the top of which is in the heavens, and make for ourselves a name, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth. So the first four verses of chapter 11 are focused on the people. They tell us what the people have come together, common language, perhaps common thinking, and they discover their ability to make Luvenim, and they decide also to build a city and a tower. In the order, they say, Nasa lanu shem, and we can stay in one place, and we won't be dispersed over the face of the earth. These are the first four verses that describe what they intend to do. So the first question would be, I think, as we begin this little study this evening, what is wrong with this, if anything? Sounds like perfectly legitimate. Even good, maybe. Everybody's coming together, unity, and they decide to build a city. They don't want to be dispersed, they want to stay together. What, if any, is the problem here? I say the problem because it appears to me that the Chumash takes a dim view of all this. The Chumash critiques it, whatever we might think. The Chumash critiques it. And the fifth pasuk tells us, Vayered Hashem, Yerot et o'ir v'yet ha-migdal asher banu b'nei ha-adam. So God goes down to see the city and the tower which the humans have made. This pasuk, which is the fifth of the nine pasukim, is a central pasuk, quite literally the central verse, because the first four verses describe what the humans intend to do. The last four verses describe what God does, in effect. And the last verse, of course, simply tells us as a postscript that the place, therefore, is called Bavel, Kisham Balar Hashem Svat Kol Haaretz. Umisham Hefitzam Hashem Al Pnei Kol Haaretz. So the nine verses divide very neatly into four, and then the central verse. God goes down to see the city and tower that the people have made. And then God decides to respond to this. They've come together as one, and now nothing will stop them. Who knows what they'll do next? Again, the word hava. Let us go down, says God, and confuse their language. That one will not ishmu, ishvat reyeu, one will not understand. Ishmoa has several different meanings: to hear, to understand, to accept. One will not, let's say, hear or understand or accept the language of one's neighbor. And from there, it says, the Torah, God dispersed them over the face of the earth. Therefore is the place called Bavel, Kisham Barar Hashem Svat Kol Haaretz, Umisham Efitzam Hashem Al Pnei Kol Haaretz. So let's say that, as a point of departure, that the Torah seems to be saying that God objects to this plan. There are two parts to the plan. One is to build the city, and one is to build the tower. And it would appear that God objects to both the building of the city, which seems to be problematic, and the building of the tower. So I wanted to try to understand what this story is actually about, and to put it in the larger context of Sefer Bereishit. So let me just very briefly outline what I think is the larger context for the story, and then deal with the more immediate context of the story, and then suggest how the story of Migdal Bavel is operative in other biblical texts as well. Let us first begin with the place of Migdal Bavel in Sefer Bereishit. I mean, many years ago, 100 years ago, there were those who argued, that the purpose of the story of Migdal Bavel was simply to tell us how language came into being. In general, there was an approach, Gaster is probably the best known of this whole group, who would give these etiological explanations of various biblical passages, stories, so he had to explain why people speak different languages. What that does not take into account is the structure of the Chumash, the place of the story within the larger context. I would also add that at least where I'm coming from, I don't believe the Torah had a particular interest in explaining how language came into being. But be that as it may, it wouldn't explain why it's here and what it's doing here in the larger narrative. So what is the larger context of these stories? So as we all know, the Chumash begins with two creation stories. The first of which is the first chapter, essentially, which describes this perfect world that's created in 6 days with God resting on the seventh day. A creation that does not involve any expenditure of energy. In fact, it's speech or thought which creates everything. The operative word is Vayomer. God is simply speaking. And there's no opposition. And there's no effort. It's effortless. That's the first, and it's perfectly ordered. The point of the first creation story is that there is an order, there is a Seder, both in terms of the 6 days and also kind of internal structure. Within the 6 days, there's an additional order. Day one corresponds to day four, 2 to 5, 3 to 6. All this is well known and is fairly obvious when you look at the Chumash. So it's about a perfectly ordered heaven and earth that God creates. That's the first creation narrative of Sefer Bereishit. And then we have, immediately afterwards, a second account of creation, which may or may not contradict the first. But that's not the point, whether it does contradict or doesn't contradict. It's obviously a very different account with a different focus. What is actually the main distinction between the first creation account and the second creation account? The primary distinction between them. There are many distinctions, there are many differences. The second one certainly focuses on the human being, whereas the first one, the human is perhaps the pinnacle of creation, but it's more about heaven and earth. It's more about everything that God creates. The human, in fact, does not have a day unto the humans, do not have a day unto themselves. They are created on the sixth day together with the animals. So yes, they're given a permission or a charge to subdue the earth, control the earth, perhaps govern the earth. It's a good question. Is it simply to subdue or to govern? I would argue it's actually to govern, to ensure that everything works properly. But in any event, the human is a creation on the sixth day and part of the larger creation. The second creation narrative certainly focuses on the human being as distinct from anything else. That's for sure. The other creations, in fact, the animals are created for the purpose of finding some helpmate for the first earthling. That's all true. But I don't think that's actually the basic distinction between the two narratives, though that is very important. It strikes me that even more central is this. The first creation narrative is dealing with heaven and earth. Shamayim v'aretz. God creates everything. The second creation narrative does not deal with heaven and earth. The second creation narrative deals with a particular place. One might say a sacred place. Gan Bi Eden Mikedem. In this place, God is walking. God is strolling in the garden. But the human being is also found in the garden, having been put there. Vayasem Sham Et Adam Asher Yatzar. The God of the second creation narrative put the earthling there that God had created. So the second creation narrative is focusing on a particular place. And in this place, God and God's creation, or most beloved creation, the human having been created in God's image and likeness, is there together with God. And something happens in that story which causes a rupture in the second creation, and the human, or humans at that point, are banished from this special place. And the rest of the Torah, and perhaps the Bible, describes an attempt to return to, not to Eden, because you can never go back there, to an alternate Eden. This is a very important point. The one who actually is almost explicit about this is, of course, the Ramban. Ramban basically more or less says this. He doesn't really embellish it, the idea, but the Ramban thinks this is the core idea of all of creation. One of the first Rambans in his commentary who takes issue with Rashi. Rashi says, why is the Torah including creation stories altogether? The Rambam doesn't like the question. So what do you mean, why? We need, it's very important. It's a basic tenet of faith. So the Rambam says, the Agadah did not mean that. Why is it? You meant, why so much detail? After all, no one understands it anyway. So why so much detail? So the Ramban says, because there's one core idea. The core idea is that sin causes banishment from sacred space. And the rest of the Chumash is about alternative sacred space. That's my language. And is it possible for the human and God to be in the same space? So that is the core difference between the two accounts. Of course, the second account is a much more full description of what it means to be a human, obviously. But the idea that the second account is about a particular place is very important. The two accounts of creation, I would add, just parenthetically, though they are clearly distinct from each other, they are not, however, completely disjunct from each other. They're not completely separate. I would say they are in dialogue with each other. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his well-known work, Lowly Man of Faith, and in truth, I'm not sure he's trying to explain the Chumash. He's trying to give a description of his view, what it means to be a human being, or a religious human being, or whatever. He uses the Chumash to that end. But in any event, he assumes in his work, fundamentally, that the two accounts are completely separate. I must say, in my humble opinion, that is not right. And they are certainly, not only are they talking to each other, but it's the Chumash makes it clear that they talk to each other in the following way. It's actually very important for an understanding of the Chumash. The first creation account, the last five verses of which, of the sixth day of creation, describe the creation of the human being. The human being, first we are told, God has the conception to create such a human being. Naseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu. So God conceives of the idea, and then the next verse says that God actually creates the human in God's image. That's the next verse. The third verse, God is giving a charge to this human, or humans at that point. Zachar u'nekeva. God gives a charge. Redu ba'aretz v'chivshua. So God gives them a charge, and that's the third verse. The fourth verse is the Chumash says that God says to the human what the human is allowed to eat. That's the fourth verse. I have given you, says God, to eat. What does the Chumash say? Let's see. I have given you, says God, Esev Zorea Zera Asher Pnei Kol Haaretz V'yet Kol Haetz Asher Bo Priyet Zorea Zera Lachem Yeru Yachar. So I've given you that with the vegetation and the fruit of the trees. And the last verse on the sixth day of creation is Uchol Chayata Aretz. But as far as the animals and the birds and all that walks over the earth, which is alive, at Koyerek Esev Liacha, I give them the grass to eat. And God saw everything was very good. It was evening, it was morning, the sixth day. I must tell you, if I were writing it, I would have written this way. What kind of an ending, what kind of climax is it to the sixth day of creation? But the animals can eat grass. I wouldn't have written it that way. I would have ended with a human being. So God created the human in God's image. That's not what the Chumash does. So the question is, why not? Before I make a suggestion as to why not, first of all, the question is a good question if we get to the answer. It's a very good question. I also happen to have a very good answer, but that's not the point. The questions help us get the answers. There's something else about the first creation story that Kasuto noticed. And he asked the following question. If you read the first chapter of the Chumash, you see that the Torah describes the kinds of thing that God creates. The trees, the luminaries, the animals, the birds, the fish. There's one thing, however, leaving the human out of it, there's one thing, however, that the Torah describes a detail of creation. Only one. On the fifth day, Vayivra Elohim et ha-taninim ha-gdolim. God created the great sea serpents. So Kosuto asked the question, why did the Torah single out the sea serpents? God created all those that live in the waters, the great fish, the fish, or whatever. Sea serpents are included, but the Torah singled out Vayivra Elohim et ha-taninim ha-gdolim. So Kosuto had the following observation about this, which I think is immense significance. He said that the first chapter of Bereshit is a story which is counter to the typical myths of the ancient Near East. In all of those accounts, you have great battles in the beginning between various forces. Typically, some of those forces are sea forces, Tanin being one of them, Tahom or Tiamat being another one, Rav being another one, Yam being another one. There were these great battles between these various forces where one force subjugates at the end the other. It does not eliminate, but subjugates the other. The Chumash in chapter 1 is making a different point. God created everything. God created this. God also created the great Taninim. There's no opposition, there's no struggle, there's no other force. In the first chapter of Bereshit, there's one force. There's one God who creates everything without opposition and without effort. Then Kosuto added, however, the other view does not die. The other view exists in other places within the Bible. Without getting into that now, it's very interesting, actually very important. But as far as Bereshit chapter 1 is concerned, there is no effort. The Tanin can't fight with God. Nobody can fight with God. Now I would add to what Kosuto has said in the following way. What he says is true about chapter 1 of Genesis, but it's not true about chapter 2 of Genesis. Because in chapter 2 of Genesis, we have somebody who does fight with God. It's one way to read the chapter. We have God's adversary that appears in chapter 2. Where this adversary is coming from is an excellent question. But in chapter 2, we have somebody who's out to fight with God. It's not the Tanin, but it's the one who is synonymous with the Tanin in the Torah, and that is the Nachash. Just reading the Sefer Shemot now recently, right? Tanin and Nachash are used there virtually interchangeably. Moses throws down his staff, becomes a Nachash. When Moses goes to Pharaoh, becomes a Tanin, the Mater, or Aaron's Mater, becomes a Tanin. Serpent. So the snake and the serpent, we use the word serpent for snake as well. So serpent and snake are used synonymously. In chapter 1, the Tanin cannot fight with God. You can't defeat God. But there is a way to defeat God, actually. You defeat God, as snakes will do, by attacking the enemy at the weakest point. And God has a weakness. Where is God's weakest point? God has one weak point, which is us. The human being is God's weak. The human being is created in God's tzelem, in God's demut, in God's likeness, in God's image, whatever that means. In fact, the very word Adam, I think, in the Chumash, although in the second creation narrative is related to Adama, but later it's related to something else. Vayolad bidmuto ketzalmo, demut. Vayikra shemam Adam biyom hibaram. The word Adam, I think, actually, in the fifth chapter, is not related so much to Adama, but rather to the word Domeh or Demut, the one created in God's likeness or God's image. So the snake attacks God at the weakest point. The snake wants to interrupt or defeat God's plan in the second creation story, which is to create a space where God's pet creation, that's us, can live together with God. And the snake doesn't want that to happen. The snake wants to separate God from God's favorite creation. Now the question is, what is the motive of the snake? One might say, of course, that snakes don't need a motive. They're snakes, you know. But if we look for a motive, if we presume the snake has a reason, then I think it's actually a very interesting question. Why is the snake doing this? In general, I would say that within that tradition, there are two ways to look at it. One way would to be the snake as a symbol of perhaps lust. He covets the woman. That's certainly a possibility in the story. And there are many midrashim to that effect. But I think there's another way to read the story as well. And that it's not that snake is so much coveting the woman, but the snake actually, the snake's main enemy is not man or woman. The snake's main enemy is actually God. And why is the snake angry at God? The snake is angry at God because the Torah says that the snake sees the man and the woman who are arumim, they're together, they're naked. And the very next verse in the Torah is, "V'nachash haya arum mikol chayat ha-sadeh asher asa Hashem Elokim." The snake was arum. Now there it probably means he's more clever. What the connection between those two words is a very interesting question. But the snake says, it's not in the Chumash, I'm just... what the snake might have said. Here they have these two humans. They're arumim. They're very special. I'm also special. I'm not like the other animals. I'm arum mikol chayat asadeh. I'm not an animal. So the snake turns to the woman and says, "Let me ask you, did your God say you can't eat any of the fruit? Af ki amar lo tochu mikol eitz hagan?" "No," says the woman, "that's not true. We can have the fruit. Just for one particular fruit we can have, the one in the middle of the garden, betoch hagan, lest we die." So who is the snake talking about that you can't have the fruit? Who is the snake referring to? Referring to himself. It's exactly the end of this first chapter. The last two verses of the first chapter are a preamble to the second story. They're not two utterly distinct stories. The story's in dialogue with each other. The Tanin of chapter 1, who is simply another creation of God, is the snake, the Nachash of chapter 2. And the snake has a particular problem with God, who has limited the snake. The snake wants to be at least on the equal of the human. Why should I be deprived of anything? Why am I relegated to the animals? They can only have the Yerek HaSadeh. That's not right. So the snake sets out to defeat God and God's plan, to separate God from God's beloved creation. And one must say that at the end of this story, the scorecard will read the following. Snake won, God nothing. Snake obviously wins the battle. Yes, the snake is cursed. Yes, the snake is eating afar, kol yimei chayav. That's all true. But at the end of the story, it's the human who is banished forever from the garden. Because the human, in taking of the fruit, as the snake said very correctly, might be like God. So the snake then, what the snake represents, we can internalize the snake as well. But fundamentally, in the second creation account, it's about God's plan to have a sacred space where God's favorite creation, the one created in God's image, is in fact present. And the end of the second creation account, the human is banished. The rest of the Chumash is about the attempt to recreate this sacred space. Now, that actually is an oversimplification, and we're getting to the Migdal Bavel very shortly. But what happens next in the Torah after the two creation accounts is we have the flood. So the flood undoes everything. God is erasing, eliminating all of creation. After the flood, however, we have the recreation of God's first creation, or God's first two creations. First, we have a recreation of heaven and earth. And we have a person that represents for us the recreation of heaven and earth. That person is, of course, Noah. And Noah is commanded to recreate the world, to multiply, to fill the earth. Noah is given dominion over the earth, even more perhaps than Adam. Noah is given responsibility for governing the earth, what we call in our tradition Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Maybe they're not seven in the Chumash, but the idea is certainly there. Shofech Dam Adam Badam Damayishav. That's what Noach's about. Noach's about recreating the world. But what Noach does not do is to recreate sacred space that he doesn't do. The Chumash leaves that to somebody else to recreate sacred space, and in two different ways. The person that recreates sacred space in Sefer Bereshit is, of course, Avraham, and he does so in two ways. The first way is God's command to Avraham in the 12th chapter, Lech lecha me'artzecha, u'mimolaretcha mi'beit avicha, el ha'aretz asher areka. So the first way, the first one might say sacred space, where Abraham is commanded to go and to symbolically possess, is the land of Canaan. That's God's first directive to Avraham, and that is the alternative to the Garden of Eden. It's not the Garden of Eden. We never return to the Garden. But it's the alternative, the alternate Eden. I'll get back to that in a minute. That's the first sacred space. And then there's the second Lech Lecha, the only two times the word actually appears. And that's chapter 22, the Akedah. Lech Lecha again to the land that I will tell you. And Avram goes to on this journey, and he sees the place from afar, Hamakom, and he actually ends up naming that particular place, which the Torah says, Asher Ye'amer Hayom Bahar Hashem Yera'eh. So that is the, he has discovered or uncovered two sacred spaces in Sefer Bereishit. The first one is the land, the place, the larger place. Within the larger place, there's a special place. Call it the place of the temple. Har Moriah, the place of the Mikdash. We have many terms for it, but it's the holy space within the holy space. The one who actually accomplishes this is, of course, Abraham. The significance of what I've just said actually is immense for an understanding of the Chumash. But let me make a very simple point about the Akedah as being the fulfillment, one might say, or the culmination, in a way, of God's creation. So that the story of Abraham, the narrative of Abraham, has to be read in two different ways. The story of Avram, the great father, is the beginning of the patriarchal narrative, the beginning of the covenantal narrative. The blessing is passed down over three generations to a fourth generation, Bnei Yisrael, etc. That's one story. That's the bulk of Sefer Bereishit. But on the other hand, the story of Avraham should be read in a very different way, which is, it's not really the beginning. In a certain way, it's the end. It's the culmination of the set of creation stories, which begins with two stories in the beginning of the Chumash, and then there's the flood and the recreation. The recreation first of Genesis chapter 1, that's what Noah accomplishes. That's Noah. Selam Elohim. Shofech dam Adam, ba'dam damoi shofech, ki b'tzelem Elohim asah et Adam. And then there's Avraham. He's different. Avraham actually recreates or lays claim to, and creates a sets up a covenant with God about the replacement for the Garden of Eden. You can never go back to Eden. In fact, the Garden of Eden, after we're kicked out of Eden, becomes a negative in the Chumash. Lot looks up, remember, leaves his Abraham, he picks up his eyes, and he sees the plain of the Jordan, Kikulam Mashke, Lifnei Shachet Hashem, Et Sedom V'et Amora, Kigan Hashem, Kieretz Mitzrayim, Boach HaTzoar. So Sodom is compared to two things. It's very lush and very fertile. So it is like the land of Egypt, like God's garden, as one comes unto Tzoar. God only has one garden, in Gan Hashem. So Gan Eden has turned into, in a sense, Mitzrayim. Now, why is that? Why can't you go back to Gan Eden? It's even negative. It sounds like it's negative. Eretz Canaan is the place. Har Moriah is the place. The Mishkan, the Migdash, that's the place. But to Eden you don't return. The reason, I think, is actually very simple. That's because Gan Eden, after Eden, after eating of the fruit, we have knowledge. Gan Eden essentially is a place in which the human being pre-knowledge exists. But once you have knowledge, once you have choice, then optimally you live in a world where your choices matter. That's what the Chumash says later, actually. The land of Canaan is not like the land of Egypt, says the Torah. The land of Egypt is always water. But the land of Canaan Hashem Elokecha Doresh Ota. God seeks it out. That is to say, God's response to human behavior. And God's response, the barometer for God's response to human behavior in the Bible, and I would add within the rabbinic tradition as well, is if God brings matar or not. If you do good, then there'll be rain. It's the second parasha of Shema. If not, that's God's response. So you live in a place where what you do matters. That's what the land of Canaan represents. What Mitzrayim represents is fundamentally you have what you need. Yes, you can act so terribly that God will bring 10 plagues. But fundamentally, Mitzrayim, Gan Hashem, is not a place where your behavior matters to God so much. Eretz Canaan is different. Now the question is, that is, I lay out the terrain of Sefer Bereishit. This is generally, you can imagine, I suppose, that this little description of Sefer Bereishit has many implications for us towards an understanding, many. But within this picture, where does Migdal Bavel fit in? That's the question. So, it's very interesting. Migdal Bavel, we don't think of Migdal Bavel has a context. The larger context is as I described, but there is the immediate context of Migdal Bavel. We don't think of it this way. But the Migdal Bavel, the story that follows Migdal Bavel, the next story in the Chumash, is the story of Abraham. Because between Abraham and Migdal Bavel, we have a bunch of names. Not that they're not important, they're very important, but narratively, the next story is Abraham being called by God, going to Canaan, going down to Mitzrayim. Those two stories are back-to-back stories, Migdal Bavel and Mitzrayim. What precedes Migdal Bavel is also very interesting. What precedes Migdal Bavel is and follows immediately are a list of names, the names of chapter 10 and the names of chapter 11, two different genealogies, different in kind, not only in name. And what's interesting is that in chapter 10, when the Torah tells us of the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Yefet, Noah's children, so the Torah starts with Yefet, and then it moves to Ham. And Ham, we are told, has four sons, the oldest of which is Cush. And Cush, says the Chumash, is the father of Nimrod. Nimrod, we are told in chapter 10, Hechel liyot gibar ba'aretz, hoya gibar tzayed lefnei Hashem, alken ye'omar ki Nimrod gibar tzayed lefnei Hashem. Vatei reshit mamrachto bavel, v'yerech v'yakad v'chalnei, v'yeret shinar. So Nimrod, his first kingdom, it's the first time in the Torah that we have the idea of kingship. The first time we have Malchut is Bavel. Reshit Mamachto Bavel, the first king is Nimrod, Be'eret Shinar. So Shinar and Bavel are identified with Nimrod. Even the very name Nimrod, we shall rebel, which the Midrash picks up on. It's not a Midrash, it's Pshat actually. The names are significant. In other words, we immediately connect Nimrod with the story of Bavel. Gibor Tzayed Lifnei Hashem, whatever that means, it's nothing good. Gibor Tzayed Lifnei Hashem, and we connect it to Bavel, and we connect it to Nimrod. Now let's get back to begin with Migdal Bavel again, and we're told the following. The world has gathered together Mikedem. So whether it's, you know, people speak about unity as being a good. It's always good to be, unity is a value. Is it a value? Depends. Under whom are we unified? That's the question. If the unifying leader would be Moshe Rabbeinu, that's a good thing. If the leader is Nimrod, it's a bad thing. The world has come together under the banner of Kedem, of Nimrod, of Bavel, of Shinar. That certainly cannot be a good thing. And they've come together, we are told, to do two things. To build, first of all, a city. And within the city, an ir u'migdal v'rosho bashamayim, a city and a tower, the top of which is bashamayim. In other words, given the structure of Sefer Bereishit, what is Migdal Bavel here? What is Migdal Bavel? Migdal Bavel, essentially, ir u'migdal. It's it's a large place, and within the large place is a very special place. There's a tower, the top of which goes to heaven. It's really, in a sense, quite parallel to what we find beginning in the next chapter with Avraham. It's what Avraham succeeds in doing. What Avraham succeeds in doing is, A, to go to the place that God directs him, which is the sacred space. Sacred because misbehavior gets you thrown out, and because God has chosen it. That's the important point. The sacred spaces in the Bible are always chosen by God, never by the human being. Torah, HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, Losum Et Shemo Sham. Naselanu Shame, the very word shame itself, which means a name, carries with it always, or often, I shouldn't say always, an additional meaning. Shame is the sacred place. The temple itself is called Shame. Losum Et Shemo Sham. Interesting is the story of Migdal Babel. Seven times we have Shin Mem, five times the word Sham, and twice the word Shame. So the human being has come together to determine where is the sacred space. For the Chumash, that's a total non-starter. But just to make the point more clear, let me return to our friend Kasuto for a minute and pick up on what he suggested. Kasuto had a very interesting question. The Chumash says, as we all know, that the place is called Bavel, Kisham Baral Hashem Sfat Kol Haaretz, because there God confused the language of the human. So the place is called Baral, to be mixed up or confused. So Kasuto says, but everybody knows, anybody who's ever studied anything from the Near East knows that Bavel is a well-known name. Are you telling me the people of Bavel called the city Bavel because they meant confusion? That would be extremely odd. That's not possible. So Kasuto says no. Of course, the Chumash is making fun of Bavel. That's not actually the reason for the name Bavel. Bavel means Bavel. What does Bavel mean? What does Bavel? Everybody knows what Bavel. What's a Bavel? Bava. Bava is a shahr. God's gate. That's what Kasuto, that's the real reason for the name. The Chumash makes fun of it. Now let me add my two cents to this. You see, we have it elsewhere in the Chumash. We have a story that plays off Migdal Babel. Migdal Babel is one what I call foundational story. There are several stories within the Bible that play off Migdal Babel. I'll mention one of them now. One of them is this. I mentioned that the creation stories, one way to read them, is they culminate with the discovery of the alternative to Gan Eden. The alternative is, of course, the sacred place, where God is both present and so is the human. So that's Har HaMoriah. In fact, it's Pshat and Chumash. Vayikra Avraham Shem HaMakom Ahu Hashem Yireh. Asher Ye'amer Hayom Behar Hashem Yireh. So it's exactly the place where God is sees and it also is seen. It's the place where God sees us and we can see God. It's the place where God and the human come together. That is the pinnacle of all creation. What Abraham has succeeded in doing is to perceive the place that God has chosen. Perception is very important in the Akedah story. The Chumash emphasizes that Abraham sees from a distance, Merachok, and he also sees behind. That's what Achar means. Achar nechaz basvach bekanav. Avram has put himself in a place, finally, where he sees perfectly. He sees everything perfectly. But the place is chosen by God. He succeeds in finding the holiest place. The Chumash calls it Hamakom, the place, at the end of his life. It's been a long journey. Now we have someone else who also discovers Hamakom. Who's the other person in Sefer Bereishit who discovers the place, Hamakom? So it's Yaakov. What does Yaakov discover? Hamakom. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Harana vayifka b'makom. He collided with, one might say, comes in contact with Hamakom, the place. Vayolan sham kiva shemesh vayikach me'avnei Hamakom, the rocks of the place. Vayishkav b'makom ahu. So the Chumash emphasizes the place. Yaakov has discovered the place. When did he discover the place? He's tired, he goes to sleep. Then he wakes up. And Yaakov, when he wakes up, he has a dream when he's sleeping. In the dream, what does he see? Sulam mutzav arza v'rosho magia hashamayma. Correct? And then he wakes up. He's very frightened. Yaakov says, Manorah hamakom azeh. The place is so frightening. Ein zeh ki im beit Elohim v'zeh shara shamayim. This is the gateway to heaven. It's Bavel. Gateway to heaven. What is the difference? The Chumash has connected the two. One is a Migdal v'rosho b'shamayim, and the other is Sulam Arz Mutzav Arza v'rosho Magia Hashamayma. In fact, in that very story, at the end of the story, Yaakov sets up a pillar v'yitzok shemen al rosha. He puts the rocks tachat mirash al tav. The word rosh actually is one of the central words in the story. Yaakov wakes up. And he takes a vow, makes a promise. But before he makes his promise, he says, Manorah ha-makom ha-zeh, Ein zeh ki im beit Elohim, b'zeh shar ha-shamayim. How do we translate the words, Ein zeh ki im beit Elohim? This is none other than, what does it mean, Ein zeh ki im beit Elohim? What is he referring to? It's not a trick question. I'm actually asking what. How do you translate? Ein zeh ki im beit Elohim v'zeh shar ha-shamayim. What does the zeh refer to? I don't think the zeh refers to where he is. The zeh refers to what's up there. In his dream, he sees the angels. God's house is on top. Yitzav alav. God is above. God directs the world from above. Yaakov has gone to sleep in a place which is directly connected below to the place above. Yerushalayim shel mala, Yerushalayim shel mata. And Yaakov says what? When Yaakov wakes up, what does Yaakov promise? What does Yaakov say? If you take care of me, says Yaakov, takes a neder. If you give me clothing to wear and food to eat, and you bring me back in peace, then what? This rock that I have set up, this pillar, Ashesamti matseva, Yiyah Beit Elohim, shall be God's house. The Sulam was Mutzav Arza. Yaakov set up a Matseva. He pours Shemen on the top of it. Yaakov says, if you allow me, if you give me the opportunity, I will build God's house here. We can't build God's house up there. We can build God's house here. One might say in our language, I take upon myself the responsibility to build God's kingdom on earth. That's what Yaakov says. And God's kingdom on earth is opposite of God's kingdom up there. There's a connection between the two of them. But God is up there and I'm over here. And maybe the twain may meet at some point. There's a connection between them, there's no question. But the human can't build the tower up there. That's Bavel. That's Bavel thinking. But Yaakov, who comes to Hamakom, to the place, unbeknownst to himself, in Pshat, Midrashim are different, in the Pshat, unbeknownst to himself, he makes promises to come back. One might say, I think this way, in Sefer Bereishit, that if Abraham discovers the place at the end of his life, his whole life is searching for the sacred space, he discovers it when he's ready to discover it, when things change in his own thinking, his own life, he's ready to understand his mission, his role, and then he sees perfectly. And that's the great culmination of Abraham's life. At the end of his life, the last time God speaks, he discovers Hamakom. For Yaakov is different in the Chumash. Yaakov discovers it by accident. Yaakov discovers it when he's unprepared. Anochi lo yodati, he says, I didn't realize it. Yaakov's mission in life is not to discover the place. Yaakov has a different mission in Sefer Bereishit. His different mission. His mission is to return to the place. Now, I think that returning to the place very often is more difficult than discovering the place. He has to come back. And twice he comes back. The first time he comes back is from the house of Lavan, where he almost doesn't come back. That begins in chapter 29, after the great vision. He goes Arza b'nei Kedem, by the way. He goes Kedma. Kedma means outside. A place which no one ever returned before. That's the first time. And the second time is when he goes to Egypt. goes to Mitzrayim. And God said to Yaakov, I will go down with you there. Anochi eredim cha Mitzrayma, v'yanochi alcha gam alo, I will bring you back. Yaakov comes back. After his death, but Yaakov's come back with the people. That's what the Medrash means when it says Jacob never died. It's actually the Pshat, not the Medrash. Of course he dies, but he lives within the people. We and Yaakov are connected. Anochi eredim cha Mitzrayma, v'yanochi, I will bring you back. Because that's Yaakov's mission, is to go back to Beit Elohim, which is not the place that he chooses, but he chooses to build God's kingdom on earth, having taken guidance from God, God's kingdom up there. When it came to Migdal Bavel, of course, the mistake was to build, or to presume, that we can build God's kingdom up there. So of course, in the central verse of Bavel, we also have God going down. Vayered Hashem, Lerote Te'ir V'yet HaMigdal, Asher Banu B'nei HaAdam. But it's not going down to bring us up. It's going down to disperse us. Us being humanity, who are dispersed from that place. From that very place. U'misham efitzam Hashem al p'nei kaharetz. So Migdal Bavel, I would say, is a kind of red herring. Migdal Bavel is the false sacred space. Migdal Bavel is the false holy place within the holy place. So Migdal Bavel, there's dispersion. In the very next story, we have the story of Abraham, who's commanded, the 10th generation from Shem, from Noach through Shem, not from Ham, not from Cush, not from Nimrod, not from Ham, but Abraham was directed to go to the place that I will show you, and ultimately to the place that I will tell you, the first being Eretz Canaan, the last being Har Moriah. By the way, one can just to imagine for a moment, what if we weren't dispersed from Babel? What if actually somehow we were able to stay in Babel? The God's means of dispersing us from Babel is that we can't understand the other. Everyone is speaking a different Safa, right? Everyone talks a different Safa. It's interesting, by the way, just as a small aside, that typically in the Chumash, the word for language is not Safa. The word for language in the Chumash typically is the word Lashon. And not just is it typically the word Lashon. If you remember your Chumash, you actually have to remember it, you have it right in front of you. If you look at the previous chapter, which describes Shem, Ham, and Yefet, after the end of each of those three genealogies, Shem, Ham, and Yefet, it's actually Yefet, Ham, and Shem, the Torah says, and they each were dispersed, each Lashonam. The word Lashon is found in chapter 10, right before Migdal Bavel. First of all, it talks about people already being dispersed before Migdal Bavel, leaving that out. But they're dispersed to different places, each according to their own Lashon. The word Lashon appears both with Shem and Ham and Yefet, not the word Safa. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, the word Safa, outside of Migdal Bavel, where it appears three times, appears in only one place in the Chumash, which is not, don't have time to get into this now, it's very interesting, maybe a bit next week, I don't know. One place we have the word for language is Safa. Where is it? Something we should know, we just read it, basically, recently. That's not in the Chumash. No, in Tanakh you have it. Tanakh you have it several places. You have several places. As far as the Torah is concerned, I think it plays on one place. And it's a place where it's clear, time does not allow a full, any kind of discussion of this. There are two parallel stories in the beginning of the second book of the Torah, which describe Moshe's reluctance to take on the mission of saving the Jewish people. The first is the lengthy story of the snare, which begins in chapter 3 and chapter 4 of Shemot. And the second is found in chapter 6. It's interesting because they seem to be totally disconnected from each. The first one, Moshe complains to God that I can't. He has many excuses why Moshe does not want to go back to Mitzrayim. One of them is, he complains to God, I'm not a good talker. What's the language? Bo'ish devarim anochi. Ki chvad peh u chvad lashon anochi. That's what he says in chapter 3 and 4. He says, Lo ish devarim anochi. I'm not a man of devarim. Of course, how does Migdal Babel start? Vikal aretz safa achat udvarim achadim. I can't explain this now, maybe if you have time next week. But in the first story, he talks about himself as kvad pech, kvad washon, and not being an ish devarim. That's his objection. God answers, Misam pel adam, don't worry about it. And then there's a very shorter story in the beginning of the second parish of Eira. There Moshe says something different to God. There Moshe says, Hein b'nei Yisrael lo shubu elai. Says it twice, actually. V'yech ishma'ini paro. The Israelites don't listen to me. You think Pharaoh's going to listen? V'ani aral svatayim. I am aral svatayim. So in the first account, where he has several excuses, they won't believe me, I have no signs. One of them is, Oish devarim anochi. The second round, he says twice, he describes himself as aral svatayim. Now what makes this extraordinarily interesting is this, that as it turns out, I mentioned the Migdal Babel story is used by several other biblical accounts, biblical stories. Jacob's ladder is one of them. But the next time you have a real use of Migdal Babel, a story that plays off Migdal Babel in many ways, is the story that appears in the beginning of Sefer Shemot. If anybody read Judy Klitzner's, has a book out of here, Judy Speak. So one of the things she talks about is that the story of the beginning of Sefer Shemot with the midwives is the language which plays off the story of Migdal Babel, which says many good things. But I will say that I don't think she has actually plumbed the depths of it. I mean, she says it's correct, but it goes way beyond that. I mean, the story of Migdal Babel is very interesting to be found at the beginning of Sefer Shemot, and actually beyond that. What I think is extraordinarily interesting is the very person that God sends to fight them, to fight Pharaoh, with his havas and with his pens and with his causing us to lose our name, which is very important, is somebody who can't talk. It's not an accident that God has chosen someone who can't speak, or who says he can't speak. Goish devarim, I'm not a man of words, at least in the first account. What God essentially says is, you think I don't know that? You want to talk, or your brother Aaron, he's a good talker. Yodati ki dabe. The first story, one gets the sense that that's even a negative. I don't want to talk. I want a doer. You're a doer. That's what I want. You can't speak. Me and you together. I'm going to be with you. Go in faith. Emotional, for whatever reason, you can't. You won't. You can't. But it's a negative. God's angry with him in the first story. What's interesting, the second story, the first story is Elish Tevarim Anochi. In the second story, it's about Aral Svatayim. So anyway, there's much more here. I can't deal with that right now, but just to point out that in the second, that the story of Migdal Babel, apart from its own intrinsic significance within Sefer Bereshit, is a story that other texts have picked up. Let me just conclude with the following observation, something to think about. I said, let's imagine for a moment that the Chumash does not continue with Abraham. Let's imagine that, yes, that people are speaking all different languages, and let me just say something else first about the different languages. There is an article which I haven't seen recently. I read it several years ago by a fellow named Fackelman. It's a short article about Migdal Babel. It's very worthwhile to get a hold of it and to read it. And I believe he makes the following point. We'll give him the credit for it. What's interesting is that in Migdal Babel, the Chumash starts off by saying the people come to this Bikah and they say to each other, let us make Luvenim, let us make bricks and burn them hard. Chomer and Luvenim, which you have in the beginning of Sefer Shemot, but they don't actually have Luvenim. The Luvena is Li'evin, the Chemar is Chomer. In other words, what the Torah speaks of is, I would say, human ingenuity. And the next step is, let us build a city. I think it's fair to say that in the Chumash, one could make a case that the Chumash is not too big on building cities. Chumash is not so much in favor of cities. My friend once suggested that when Cain said to God, God said to Cain, your brother's blood cries out from the ground, and now you are banished. Navanad. So Cain said, Gadol avonim min so, which most Mefarshim take to mean, punishment is too great. You have chased me out from before you. I will be hidden from your face. Whoever finds me is going to kill me. So God gave Cain a protective sign, a mark of protection. Vayetze Cain mizufnei Hashem. So Cain left God's presence. What's the first thing Cain does? He builds a city. What is a city? A city is a place where you can't find God. I mean, that's what my friend suggested. In the Chumash, I wouldn't say you can't, from our perspective, Jewish is right in Wicked Center, you know what I mean? It's right there. Where you can find God, but you have to look. And the point is, the Chumash is uncomfortable, I would say, with cities in general. But it's about human ingenuity, it's about the use of the language, the Levenaz Le'evin. So what is God's response? What does God say? Hava Nerda V'Navla Sham Svatam. What is Navla? Nun Bet Lamed Hey is a jumble of which word? Levena. In other words, the use of language is interesting. The story is about the power of language. Language can transform things. Levena can be Le'evin. Chemar can be Chomer. God says, conversely, says God, I can also change things. I can take the Levena and V'navla Sham Svatam. I can confuse it. So it's about human possibility. Cain is the builder of a city. Cain is the father of technology. Cain is the father of music. Cain is also a killer. Cain has the tools can be used positively and very negatively. But in any event, so Bavel is about the city, and of course the Migdal v'Rosho b'Shamayim v'Nasalanu Shem is clearly problematic. God goes down, which is both mocking the human, the tower that the humans have built, but going down also carries with a sense of judgment. God goes down to Sodom, right? Erdonav v'Yareh. God goes down to Mitzrayim. V'Yireh l'Atzilo miyad Mitzrayim. There's a sense of judgment. What if we were still in Bavel? But we can't be in Bavel because we all speak different languages. But what if we could all speak different languages and still be in one place? Imagine such a thing. And there is one. There is a unifying, something that unifies all the people, all the different languages. Can we imagine such a possibility? We can imagine it because we have a book of the Bible dedicated to precisely that proposition. There's one book of the Bible, front and center. It's a book we're all very familiar with, dear to my heart. It's called Megillat Esther. That's how the book begins. 127 languages. Right? And it emphasizes it. Medina u'medina kichtava v'yam v'am kilshono. And later, el hayudim kichtav. The Jews don't even have a state. They have a language. They have a writing and a language. I would add to the writing and the language the idea of the Sefer as being very central. The Sefer that is sent out. And there's one king. There's HaMelech. From beginning to end is Achashverosh. So imagine. Imagine you live in a world. Nimrod is the king. There's no Abraham. There's no Akedah. There's no Eretz Canaan. What if the world in which we lived were actually Babel? I think that is, I would say, the conceit. That is the beginning. That's the assumption of the story of Megillat Esther. And here's what's very interesting about that, and with this I will end. If you think about, for example, the first chapter of Sefer Shemot. Because the point of this, the real interesting point here, I think, is how these, what I call, foundational stories, before you get to the Midrashim, before you get to our rabbinic tradition, Torah Shabbat, within the Bible itself, there's an inner biblical tradition. One text plays off another. And there are certain stories that are foundational texts. Stories, for the most part, in Breshit are that way. Kedat Yitzchak's foundation appears in many places. Other texts use that story. Migdal Bavel, beginning of Sefer Shemot. Pharaoh says there are too many. Hava is the prison. Chacham is always a bad word. Hava nitchak molo, pen your bet. Right? That's how he starts. We come down with names. Eilu shemot. By the second chapter in Exodus, we have no names. A man from Levi, a woman from Levi, a sister, a mother, a child. No names. Pharaoh obliterates our name. It's all playing off Migdal Babel, but it's playing off another story. Let's kill the boys and take the girls. Cholabat chayun, as the Ramban explained. What does he care? Take them. So it plays off another story. Story of Paro and Abraham and Sarah and Mitzrayim, which is the next story. It's exactly the next story. It's not far away. We don't think of it that way, because one is Parshas Noach, one is Parshas Lech Lecha. It's the next story. It's the next narrative. The two stories come together. So what's interesting to think about is, number one, in the beginning of Sefer Shemot, we have a story which combines, which plays off simultaneously two stories. One is Babel, and I even get to the depth of the Babel story. I can't do that now. And clearly, Mitzrayim, taking the girls, killing the boys, etc. The Avdut and the Inui of chapter 1, the Gerut, it's the same story, essentially. The Ramban points this, it's the same story. So what's interesting is, the Gilad Esther is also very interesting from this perspective. It describes a world. The world of the Book of Esther. What is this world? So from one perspective, it's the world of Babel. Everybody's talking a different language. And yet there's a unity of sorts. There's a melech. But the main point of Megillat Esther, of course, the main story that it recalls in so many ways, is the story of Yosef. If Mordechai and Esther are Yosef, then where are they living? They're living in Mitzrayim. The culture of the Megillah is the culture of Mitzrayim. So the Megillah is interesting. The Megillah uses simultaneously, recalls for us, goes back to Bereshit in a very profound way, and recalls for us two stories, which in the Chumash are back-to-back stories. The first is Babel, the world of many languages, the world of disunity, but somehow a kind of unity is established in the Megillah. At the same time, we have a culture of Mitzrayim, a culture of seeing and taking, a culture of not having any memory. No one remembers anything. How do you live in such a world? That's what the Megillah actually, that's the question of the Megillah. How do you function in a world where God seems completely absent? In the world of Babel, who needs God? Because Nasa Lanu Shem. We're here on earth and we're up there in heavens as well. Nasa Lanu Shem. There's no place for God in Babel. Another place. So that's what the Megillah invites us to imagine, such a world. That's the challenge. How does one retain one's own moral compass and one's identity in such a world? So just to sum up with a little bit that we have looked at this evening, the really interesting thing, for me anyway, is to see how these stories are used by other texts. And in used by other texts use them in different ways. If we have a chance next week, I wanted to go into that, because the book of Exodus uses it one way, and the story of Yaakov and the ladder to heaven is another way, and Megillat Esther is using it in a third way. Hopefully we have an opportunity next week to study that a bit. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to take briefly any comments or questions. Accept everything I told you. I should never do that. But, okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
It might be in the city.
God is all you know. God is all you know.